The reason why this is difficult, if we talk about theological method and like how do people get to the conclusions that they get to, is because there's three genres in the book of Revelation. And the question is like, what are the predominant genres and what else is it? So there's apocalyptic, prophetic, and epistolary, which means it's a letter. Okay, so different views, those different views on like futurism, preterism, and idealism, they all say that one of those three aspects of Revelation is the primary.
For many people, the study of the end times can feel mysterious and disorienting. But upon examination, what you find is that there are really only three main lenses through which people interpret the eschatological texts in the Bible. In this episode, my friend Aaron Salvato from the Good Lion podcast interviews me about the end times passages in the Bible, and I lay out the three different ways these passages have been interpreted and why. I outline the futurist, the preterist, and the idealist positions, and I explain how they correspond to premillennialism, postmillennialism, and amillennialism. I also weigh the strengths and weaknesses underlying these different interpretations. I hope this conversation will bring clarity to this subject for you. I'll be back at the end with some final words.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Good Lion podcast. Aaron here, and today on the show I have my old friend Nick Cady back on the show. Nick is the lead pastor of Whitefields Community Church in Longmont, Colorado, and he is so stinking smart. I love this guy. He's been such a great friend and mentor to me over the years, and Nick really has a lot of wisdom and insight on the topic of eschatology, which, as you guys know, for longtime listeners of the show, that is not an area of expertise for me. It's an area where I'm still learning and growing. So I thought it'd be great to have Nick on the show to discuss all things eschatology. We're going to look at the four main views of eschatology. We're going to try to dive in and understand these different perspectives. We're going to look at the role of Israel in eschatology, the difference between the pre-mill view and the dispensationalist view. We're going to get into some interesting conversations about how our eschatology can affect our ethical views. And we're going to poke at some of the ways our eschatology can shape our Christian identity, ministry, and practice. Oh, by the way, before we get into the episode, I have to say, after the episode I did on eschatology with Daryl Bach, my dad reached out to me and said, "Hey, that was one of the best episodes you've ever done." My dad is a big fan of the topic of eschatology. But my dad said, "When you talk about how you grew up in Calvary and you heard a lot of crazy viewpoints and obsessions among dispensationalists around politics," my dad was like, "Hey, can you let people know that wasn't from me?" And he's 100% right. My dad hardly ever talked about crazy politics. He's probably one of the most balanced people that I know. So it was not my dad, but it was other people and influences. So just wanted to clear his good name. If you hear me reference any crazy idea from my past, don't assume it came from my dad. Okay, great. Now that we got that out of the way, let's jump right back into my conversation with Nick Cady around eschatology. Welcome back to the show. How are you, man?
Doing well. Yeah, always good to be with you, Aaron. So thanks for having me on.
It's always good to be with you, man. Seriously, I'm a big fan of you. You're a friend. You've been a mentor. You've been a constant source of encouragement for me. And I love working with you at CGN. I love all the stuff we get to do together. And I'm glad you're here because today's episode is all about eschatology. And I am not very good at talking about eschatology. There's lots of episodes on this show where I come in where I have something I want to talk about. I'm passionate. I know things and I want to share those things. This is one of those episodes where I am the student and I'm looking for a master, and you are the Jedi master that I've locked onto.
All right, well, hopefully I can help.
I mean, that's part of your title for CGN, right? Like master of eschatology.
I'm not quite sure that's right.
What's your background with eschatology? How do you know so much about it? Because I listen to you talk and I'm like, how does he retain all of this information.
Yeah, well, so the short version is that I felt inadequate in this area and in many areas of my life. So I did a couple things. One of them was years ago, you know, over 10 years ago now, I enrolled in seminary. I remember I became a pastor at 21 years old, planted a church, and I quickly found out as I was teaching the Bible that I could either just kind of parrot what I was hearing from other people or what I read in books, or I could actually learn things for myself. And I felt that in order for me to have a level of kind of credibility for my, even for my own sake, I wanted to actually know that these things I was talking about were true and why I believe them and what the arguments against them were, etc. So at the time I was living in Hungary and I enrolled in a seminary in England because I thought, hey, having a British degree is probably better than some of my other options that I had in the region. And so I enrolled there with the, actually with the goal of just taking a couple classes and not finishing the degree. Ended up being like, once you get into it, you're like, well, I might as well get the degree since I've gone this far. And then after that, one of my professors had told me at my graduation ceremony, said, you know, you should really pursue a master's. And so a couple of years later, I did that. And that was in the topic of integrated theology, which is it actually almost, I'm not sure that the name integrated theology or integrative theology is as helpful as you might think, because really integrative theology is about the practice of what's called theological method, which is the study of how people reach theological conclusions. Now, the only reason I bring that up is because that's actually really important for talking about eschatology, is understanding, okay, what, how did these different views on eschatology develop over the many centuries? And why did some people come to one conclusion and other people come to another conclusion if we're all reading the same Bible? That's what theological method is all about, which is what integrative theology studies. And in addition to that, just in the last year, people from my church for years had been asking me, Nick, when are you going to teach Revelation in the church? And I know it was really also in vogue for people to be, at least maybe in our circles, to be teaching Revelation during the pandemic. And so I had always told them, you know what, before I teach you Revelation, I want to have kind of a classroom style class in which I teach you about eschatology as a whole and help you understand a little bit of the background behind it, as opposed to just going verse by verse through Revelation. I think that in order to appreciate Revelation and understand it and also not get off into weird stuff or maybe even miss the point, we need to back up a little bit and talk about eschatology as a whole. So we have a thing at our church called the Bible Learning Center. Originally, it was called School of Ministry and Discipleship. And then we renamed that School of Ministry. And then we renamed that Bible Learning Center, just kind of trying to find a name that really reflects what we're doing there. And basically, these are classroom style courses that are taught by leaders in our church who have expertise in different areas. We like to call it Bible College for people who don't have time for Bible college. Or maybe like community college meets Bible college. And eventually we hope that this ministry will actually outgrow our church and will become its own standalone thing. So someday we'll see what God does with that. But through that, I said, that's the perfect forum for me to teach eschatology. So we did it in our church, ended up using our sanctuary for it because we had a lot of people who signed up for this class. And so I took people through an 8-week course, the first 4 weeks of which were giving an overview of eschatology and how to understand it.
That's awesome, Nick. I love that. I love the whole school of ministry / discipleship thing we're doing right now, the Good Lion School of Discipleship. We were going to call it School of Ministry, realized School of Discipleship was a better fit for the vision. So I totally get that. I love that you're doing it. I wish more pastors would do this kind of thing, because I feel like when you're just teaching through books of the Bible, the people are getting so much from it, but then there's certain things that don't get unlocked until you're able to really focus on it and go in depth into it. And once you do that, when you're then sitting in an expositional through the Bible series, what you learn in those kind of classes just unlocks so much for you. So yeah, you know, for me, eschatology has never been a huge focus, and I want to get better at it. You're talking about, you know, theological method and why people come to their conclusions. And just, let's just be honest, for many of us guys in Calvary, the reason we got to the conclusion of premillennial dispensationalism is because that is what our previous generations held to and passed down to us. And so for a lot of us, it's like there's not much thinking that goes beyond that. So yeah, I'd love to have you serve as a teacher for this conversation to help us just understand some of this stuff better.
A good way to start would be by defining what is eschatology, and I just have a few thoughts on that. Eschatology, it comes from the Greek word ta eschata, or ta eschata, which means the last things. So it's the study of the final things. Now, people might ask the question, is eschatology a primary doctrine, or is it a secondary doctrine? Here's how I would answer that. I would say that eschatology is a primary doctrine in one sense, but the details, like when you get beyond the, there are primary aspects to it, but once you get a little bit below that into the details of how people understand the nuances and specifics of how it plays out, that becomes secondary.
Could you sort of phrase it like this? The fact that Jesus is returning and the fact that he will establish his kingdom is an essential core doctrine, but the nitty-gritty details of how that plays out and when it happens and how it happens, that's where we get into the secondary argument.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, if you look at some of the early Christian creeds, so like the Apostles' Creed, Nicene Creed, they all talk about the return of Jesus and the end of all things. And in that sense, these are primary doctrines. These are things which are absolutely core, basic elements to what it means to be a Christian. But as far as how those will play out and how we should understand these texts in their details, yeah, I would say that that is where it becomes secondary. And that's where we need to have grace and collegiality with other Christians.
Wait, you mean so we shouldn't completely write people off for having different eschatology?
Right, yeah, of course, you know, and I think, yeah, it's really important for people to understand the primary versus secondary thing and like what that means in the family of God, the household of God, right? The people of God. So
yeah. Yeah, no, that family analogy has always stuck with me because I've always felt, or not always, because I grew up, you know, typical Calvary where no one tells you this, you just latch onto it. This idea of anybody who's not a dispensationalist is like on the same level as an atheist or an evolutionist or some liberal progressive. I don't know why this happens. I feel like this probably happens in other denominations too. You just latch onto your way of thinking and anyone else is the enemy. But I think to fight about it is like, you know, kids fighting over what time dad said he'd get home instead of focusing on dad saying, clean the house because I'm coming home. We're going to have a party. You just spend all your time fighting over, he said he'd be home at 8. Actually, he's already home. He's in the garage. You just don't know. You know what I mean? Like,
No, that's really good. So I would argue this, that all of the Bible and all of Christianity is eschatological. So sometimes people might ask, what parts of the Bible are eschatological? I would say, all of Christianity is eschatological. The reason the Bible exists is to tell us the story of the eschatological hope. The hope, in other words, what that means when we say that Christianity is eschatological, it means that the Judeo-Christian faith, biblical teaching, is that history is linear, not circular or cyclical. Right. Some people would say, like even other major religions, including pagan religions, but also, you know, other major religions that are still popular today, particularly Eastern religions, would say that time is cyclical. And whereas Christianity says, no, it's linear. It has a starting point and everything is moving towards a culminating event. That culminating event in Greek is called the eschaton, which is part of that whole terminology from the root word ta eschata, the end times or eschatology. So You know, there are some relevant passages. I'll just bring up a few. Obviously, Revelation is a big deal in this discussion. Also, we've got other passages like Daniel 2, Daniel 9, Isaiah, and the other Old Testament prophets are very much, they have eschatological features. The Olivet Discourse is very important in this discussion, which is found in Matthew 24 and 25. It's also found in Mark 13 and in Luke chapter 21. And then the books of 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, particularly 1st Thessalonians 4 and 2nd Thessalonians 2. Now, there are other eschatological texts, but these are some of the major ones. And so they're worth looking into. But the question is, you know, how do they fall into the eschatological framework that we need to build?
So the definition of the word eschatological is, what was it again? Is it future things, things of the future?
No, not necessarily. And that's actually an important discussion that we should have in just a minute. Mm. But it is the study of the last things, final things. Being that culminating event that everything in history is building up towards.
So the recurring thread that you're talking about, that you're seeing in all these places in scripture, is the Bible's not just a history book telling us about things that happened in the past, but it's building towards something that will happen at the end. Is that a good way to view
it? Yes. So we could say this. There are a few key features of Christian eschatology. One is that we are moving towards the, what's also called, important term in this discussion, what's called the parousia or parousia. People pronounce it differently, but it means arrival. And what that means is we're awaiting the second coming of Christ. We're awaiting the inauguration of God's kingdom. That's another important discussion. When is God's kingdom inaugurated? When does it come to earth? So there are a few key features of Christian eschatology. One has to do with the inauguration of God's kingdom. The other has to do with the parousia, or arrival, of Jesus. And the third one has to do with immortality and eternal life.
All right. That makes sense. That's a good, simple layout for a non-simple, complex thing. Man, parousia. Do theologians make up these fancy words to sound smart? Or is it more like people were smarter back when they first came up with the words?
Well, it's more like people just haven't translated Greek words. That's all it comes down to.
There you go. Okay, so let me ask you this. Can you give us a brief overview of each of the main core streams of thought when it comes to eschatology? I know there's more than three, but aren't there three main ones, or is there more?
Yes, so there are three main ones, and here's what, actually, there used to be four, but now it's dialed down to three. I'll explain that in a second. Okay, so basically,
did one of them absorb another one,
well,
or something?
In a way, you could say one of them was just, it was proven wrong by history. So, yeah.
Oh, great. Let's okay,
so
get into it.
The four major interpretations of the eschatological text can be broken down in these ways. People who read the texts in what are called, I'll give you three isms. You've got preterism, futurism, and idealism. So preterism, futurism, and idealism. Now, this makes it, those sound, again, like words that are like, I don't even know what that means. It's really simple. The preterism means that you believe that most of the eschatological texts, if not all, in the Bible, are speaking about things which have already happened, particularly with Revelation. Right? So you're saying that the book of Revelation actually depicts things which have already taken place. That's preterism. Then futurism is when you read Revelation, you believe that it's actually talking about things which have not yet taken place, or at least most of the book has not yet taken place. Where people put that line as far as what regards future things, you know, that varies a little bit, but not very much in futurism. And then idealism is a reading of Revelation and other eschatological texts which say that these things don't actually correspond to specific events in history, either in the past or in the future, but rather they speak of the recurring cycle of events, timeless truths, if you will, that are portrayed or illustrated in a dramatic way about the battle between good and evil, which will always go on until Jesus returns. Oh, the fourth one, which I mentioned, that is called historicism. Now, historicism was very popular during the Reformation, particularly with guys like Martin Luther. You know, Martin Luther really believed that he was living in the times described by the Book of Revelation, and he believed that the Catholic Church was very much involved and was being depicted in the prophecies in Revelation. And
did he draw lines to the beast? Did he think of the Catholic Church 100%. As the beast?
And, you know, you could get into all of his stuff, but yeah, he was saying the Catholic Church is this, the Pope is that, when he's reading the Book of Revelation.
The whore of
exactly,
Babylon.
Exactly, yeah. And then he made predictions about what was going to happen, you know, with these things and how it was going to play out. And that historicist view or interpretation of Revelation has kind of faded off into history. And even like Lutherans would not hold to that view. Most of them would not hold to those views anymore because it's kind of just been canceled out by history.
Man, it's humbling when you learn that someone like Martin Luther can be actually wrong about stuff, including the Jews, but that's a whole nother conversation. Yeah. Don't Google Martin Luther and the Jews, everybody. I remember I was a youth pastor at Laser Tag, and I got on my phone and an article popped up about Martin Luther's views on the Jews, and that was the most depressed I ever was playing Laser Tag after I read that.
Well, Aaron, but anyway, I don't know if you knew this, but I grew up Lutheran, and I was born again when I was 16, but prior to being born again, I grew up Lutheran, and you know, so I had to actually study a lot about Martin Luther. Now, I'll tell you, the Lutheran perspective on Luther's view on the Jews is that was written during a time when he had some really bad intestinal problems. This is actually how he died, was from intestinal problems. And so the theory is that at least the excuse perhaps, is that this went to his brain and like affected his ability to think clearly and made him say all kinds of crazy stuff.
Well... Great. Moving on. So can you get into the labels that we've created for people who hold to these different streams? The ones I can think of off the top of my head are premillennialism, postmillennialism, and amillennialism. Am I missing anything?
No, that's a good place to start. And those actually correspond.
Where do the preterists usually fall?
Depends on what kind of preterist you are, but generally preterism falls in with postmillennialism. But before I say that, let me just say this. The reason why this is difficult, if we talk about theological method and like how do people get to the conclusions that they get to, is because there's three genres in the Book of Revelation. And the question is like, what are the predominant genres and what else is it? So there's apocalyptic, prophetic, and epistolary, which means it's a letter. Okay, so those different views on like futurism, preterism, and idealism, they all say that one of those three aspects of Revelation is the primary. So for example, idealists say that Revelation is primarily apocalyptic. Futurists say it's not primarily apocalyptic, it is prophetic, and it even claims to be prophetic. And therefore, it's speaking about future events in a way that can be understood. And then, yeah, the people with the preterist view, they look at it kind of more of as a mix of all three of those. But yeah, your question had been, what are these three views on the millennium and how do they correspond to views about the eschatological text? Okay, so premillennialists tend to be futurists. So if you read the Bible or you read the Book of Revelation particularly and say this is speaking about the future, most likely you are a premillennialist. You might also be an amillennialist, but not necessarily. Now, then the next one is postmillennialism, which corresponds to preterism. Some preterists would say that they're amillennialists. Some would even claim to be a little bit futurist. And then amillennialists are idealists. So when they read the Book of Revelation, they say this is not corresponding to actual events, but rather just kind of giving us the big picture. So that's how they, so premillennialists are futurists, postmillennialists are preterists, amillennialists are idealists. Now, why do we use that term millennial? That's an important question, because in Revelation 20 verses 1 through 10, we read about a 1,000 year or millennium, a 1,000 year period of Christ's reign on earth. And so these different views about the futurist view of Revelation, the idealist view of Revelation, and the preterist view of Revelation, they all interpret the millennium in different ways. So amillennialism means that in that view, they would say the millennium, 1,000 years, is not an actual 1,000 year period of time. It could be 2,000 years. It could be 5,000 years. Nobody knows. It just means a really long time.
You're saying this is the amillennialism? This is the amillennial view. I had thought, and this is where there's going to be so many things that I don't understand correctly, so I'm asking for clarity, but I had thought that amillennials viewed the millennium more as a metaphor.
That's right. They do.
Okay. Okay.
And so they would say, you know, many amillennialists believe that we're living in that time right now. And they have a way of explaining why that is. Next, you would have preterists, right? And so
Wait. Let's stay fixated on that just for a second. So an amillennial person could potentially believe that we are currently living in the millennial reign of Christ. I don't understand how you would cross that bridge looking at the current state of the world.
Yeah. And that's also true of postmillennialists, who would say that we are either in the 1,000 year reign of Christ right now, or the 1,000 year reign of Christ has ended. And some postmillennialists would say the entire book of Revelation has ended. So when you read about the new heavens and the new earth, they would say we're actually living in that right now as well.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. And we can get deeper into that eventually. But yeah, this is interesting stuff.
So, and then premillennialism essentially believes that the millennial kingdom will happen after Jesus' return, either his return to rapture the church or his return in his second coming. But they believe that it will happen after Jesus' return. So Jesus will return prior to the millennium, where that's premillennialism. And then the postmillennialists, of course, believe that Jesus will return after the millennium is over. Mm.
Already swimming. It's the kind of thing that I feel like I need to like grab a big book on it and just go slowly through it with a highlighter. But I'm very thankful for conversations like this, because it gets my gears turning on it again. So I wanted to go through each of the three main views and just get, you know, out of theory and into practice with it and get really tangible, because I think that'll be helpful for not just the listeners, but for me. And so this is a CGN podcast. We've got listeners that are not a part of CGN. Hey, we love you guys. You're awesome. For Nick and I, we're both pastors within the Calvary Chapel movement. And so my question is, you know, for those of us in Calvary, the Calvary circles, we have historically been premillennial. Why are we that? Where did that come from? Is that Chuck Smith, did he get into that on his own? Is that a hangover from the Foursquare days? Because that's, you know, where Chuck's theology comes from, is Foursquare, and then he developed some of his own things. But yeah, why do we hold to that? And then just for you personally, Nick, what have been the things as you've studied that have compelled you to remain in the premillennial stream?
Yeah, there's more than we probably have enough time to talk about here, but I'll give you a few. Okay, so why did Calvary Chapel, like in our roots, why did we end up with this eschatology? Yeah, I mean, you could say that it was because of the church background that Chuck Smith was a part of, but here's the bigger picture, that there was a resurgence of premillennialism as a doctrine starting in the 1800s. And okay, so you could look at it this way, historically, and this is not a matter of debate, right? This is a matter of fact. We know that the first eschatological position that was held by early Christians is what's called historical premillennialism. historical premillennialism, which differs, by the way, from premillennial dispensationalism, which is what Calvary Chapels hold to. Now, CGN has just said we to be part of CGN, not necessarily like because we have churches in CGN that are not Calvary Chapels. And so to be Calvary Chapel, you are a premillennial dispensationalist. I can explain what that means in a minute if you'd like. But historical premillennialists are also welcome under the CGN banner, which is a little bit broader. And so I think that's really important to note, that the very first Christian eschatology was a premillennial eschatology, which meant it was a futurist reading of the book of Revelation. They were looking forward to that coming.
I love that you bring up that historic premillennialism was the first view of the early church, because, you know, for me as somebody growing up in Calvary, I have heard my whole life criticisms about dispensationalism. And I remember talking to a friend of mine who was, you know, he's kind of a mentor, and he was going off just about some of his things he was displeased with, you know, different shapes dispensationalism has taken. But then I started describing some of my views, and he was like, well, yeah, that's just historic premillennialism. That's beautiful. I have no problem with that. You know, for him, it was just some of the, in his views, left turns that dispensationalism had taken. But for me, that's comforting to know that, you know, it's not, you can hold to premillennialism without necessarily jumping on the dispensationalist bandwagon.
And I would say this, that I personally would call myself a progressive dispensationalist. And I actually think that most Calvary Chapels are progressive dispensationalists, even if they don't know that terminology.
I found out I am. Yeah. Yeah, I took a quiz where it was just, you know, asking me all of my, you know, views on different eschatology things. And there was a lot of things I was like, I'm undecided about this. I'm still figuring this out. But everything that I answered pointed towards progressive dispensationalism. And if anyone listening, if your alarm bells are going off and you hear the word progressive, we're not talking about dyeing our hair blue and
right. I mean, I told that to my church too. I said, you know, don't be thrown off by the word progressive here. It's actually speaking about how the dispensations take place.
It has nothing to do with politically progressive politics. Yeah. So, or even progressive Christianity. Yeah, so keep going, Nick. You keep explaining why you hold to the
views. Yeah, so the short answer is because a few things. Is that let's start with premillennialism. Basically, because when I read the eschatological texts, I believe that they're speaking about future events because they describe things which have not yet happened in history. And maybe some things have happened in part, but they haven't happened in fullness. Like even if you read the prophetic books, the things they talk about have not yet taken place. Here's another thing. When I was in seminary, I thought that I had converted to being an amillennialist, meaning that I thought that these things were speaking about, and not a literal 1,000 years, but that they were symbolic, they were metaphor. And maybe their best argument, by the way, and this is the one that really kind of almost like changed my mind, is if you go into the prophetic books like Isaiah, I believe it's like chapters 12 and a few other chapters that talk about what this time, this future time will be like when righteousness covers the earth like water covers the sea, and what will take place. It's talking about a future event. Now, dispensationalists and, well, premillennialists, they believe that what's being described there is the millennial reign of Christ on earth prior to the great judgment and the final judgments, and then the final locations where those people go off to, being hell, the lake of fire, and the new heavens and the new earth. So there's that 1,000-year reign. And so I had always heard in Calvary Chapel that those passages were describing that. But then the amillennialists I was listening to made a really convincing argument to say, no, what that's describing is the new heavens and the new earth. And they say, you know, that's describing God's kingdom come to earth, and, you know, this is what it's going to be like. The wolf will lay down with the lamb. The child will play at the den of the adder. Like, these are things that are coming on earth in forever in heaven, and that the future earth will be much more of a renewed and fulfilled earth than it will be an ethereal thing where we float around on clouds and play harps and wear diapers or something, right? So I found that very convincing. And here's what happened. I was a Calvary Chapel pastor. I was pastoring in Hungary. I happened to be back in California, and I met with Brian Brodersen. And I told, we were at a coffee shop, I remember exactly, and I said, Brian, I think I'm an amillennialist. And in about 10 minutes' time, he talked me out of it. It turns out that wasn't his first time meeting an amillennialist. So he said, okay, well, here's the big problem with amillennialism, is he said, if you read those passages, what you'll notice is that those passages describe there being sin during those times. Mm. And he said, well, in other words, to believe that, you have to believe that there will be sin in the new heavens and new earth, in heaven. And that's just not possible if we believe what the scriptures say. So it's actually a more literal reading of the text that led me back to a premillennial view. And I'll say this too, is that here are some characteristics of a futurist interpretation of the Bible, particularly of dispensationalism, but also of historic premillennialism. Number one, a commitment to literal interpretation. So if you want to ask the question, why does Calvary Chapel hold a futurist view of eschatology? Here's the number one reason. Because of a commitment to literal interpretation.
Across the board, through all scripture.
Which is based on a view of the Bible, which we call perspicuity. Now that's a unclear word to say clarity. It actually literally just means clarity. Mm. So maybe we'll just call it that. The clarity of scripture. And what we mean by clarity of scripture is we believe that the Bible has been given to us in a way that is understandable. Not everything is equally understandable, but the intent of the Bible is that those who read it would understand it. Now, this is a really big problem then for those who hold, let's say, a amillennialist, idealist perspective on Revelation and the eschatological text, because essentially what they're saying is that we can't really know what any of these things are pointing to. It's just vague, and we're basically just supposed to like let it wash over us and come away with the view that Jesus wins in the end. I understand that.
I do not want to paint with too broad a brush. I'm just trying to see if this link between something here is just something I've noticed, or if it's kind of something that's noticed by many and even, you know, like an established fact. But from what I've noticed, it seems like those who in general, not an exclusive rule, but those in general who hold to a more theologically orthodox conservative view of theology are usually those who lean more pre-mill or post-mill, and then those who hold to more of a progressive or liberal view on theology tend to lean more a-mill. I don't know if that's a stretch, though, because I know I can think of off the top of my head like a 10 respected theologians that lean a-mill, and they're super theologically orthodox and conservative. But I think I'm talking more denominations. The denominations that lean more progressive tend to be more a-mill, and it's like a... it's an interpretation thing where a lot of stuff in the Bible they view as, well, we can't really know for sure what that means. It's probably a metaphor, you know?
Yeah, I resonate with what you're saying, and it might
be wrong.
Generally true, but I would hate to put that label on to all the people who hold an amillennial position, because we can say this, that after, so if I would say it's more tied to history and the development of theology and development of eschatology over the years than it is tied to conservatism versus liberalism when it comes to theology. So for example, we had started out saying the first theology of the Christian church was historical premillennialism. Well, within a couple hundred years, that shifted to being an amillennial perspective, and the amillennial perspective has been held by more Christians throughout history than any other perspective.
Okay. So that's just my ignorance then. Yeah, and that's probably that's probably me seeing some very vocal and public liberally and progressive theologians, and they just happen to be Amil. So yeah, no, that's interesting. What was the reason for the change? Why did it shift?
There are some different theories on it, but most of them have to do with the realities of the Roman Empire. And also thinking through, like, dealing, you know, when we talk about theological method, it's the method by which you do theology. And that includes scripture. But of course, it starts with scripture, but it also quickly moves to, okay, but how do we interpret those scriptures? Do we interpret them based off of reason? Do we interpret them based off of history? Do we interpret them based off of our present experience? The answer is yes, we do all of those things, but which things get pride of place? Which one are we giving priority to? And how are we giving the hierarchy of those things in relation to each other? So for example, with this, you know, when Rome was persecuting Christians, you could really understand how you could read Revelation and say, well, this is clearly talking about what God is going to do to Rome. But then when Rome is converted to Christianity and it becomes the official religion of the thing, and now Rome is actually supporting Christianity as opposed to persecuting it, well, that changes the way you think and reason and read those scriptures and say, what does that mean? Yeah. Also, that historical thing is actually the thing which has led to every one of these positions, because people at different historical times, like we talked about Martin Luther's view, but we talk about people at different historical times looking at Revelation and trying to overlay it on what's happening in their day and trying to put the pieces together. So with the, I mean, we can get into some of these views later on, but let me just skip ahead to dispensationalism. And you had asked the question, why does Calvary Chapel hold this position? Okay, I'll tell you. Number one, it's because of a commitment to literal interpretation. Number two is because of a distinction that we believe that there is a distinction between Israel and the church. Now, that was not always held throughout history. A lot of people throughout history, and again, this had a historical reason, but they believed that Israel, when the Bible talked about Israel or had promises to Israel in the Old Testament, that those promises would not be fulfilled through the literal nation state of Israel, but would be fulfilled now through the church as the spiritual Israel, sometimes called replacement theology. Mm. And so what happened is that in the late 1800s, there was a movement which actually started with a Austro-Hungarian Jew named Theodor Herzl. Mm. He's from Budapest, actually, and there's a big monument to him in Budapest, but he is the father of the Zionist movement. The Zionist movement was the movement that said that the Jews, particularly in Europe, but also in the Middle East, needed to repatriate to what was at that time called Palestine, but is now the area of Israel. And so it's a historical.
What does repatriate
mean? Repatriate means to change your citizenship. They needed to move there and resettle that land and work towards a Jewish nation state. Now, that was really a Jewish movement. Some of those were theologically driven. Others were driven by other reasons like safety and security, a place where they wouldn't be persecuted, etc. But Christians started looking at that and they started saying, wait a second, maybe all those passages in the Bible that talk about Israel in the future actually are talking about the future, and they're not just talking about the church, but they're actually talking about the nation, the people of Israel, the Jewish people, back in the land. And then it got their wheels turning. Well, then, see, one of the problems with reading Revelation prior to that was that you had said, well, it talks about Israel being in the land and needing to flee from Jerusalem, but we all know that Jerusalem is not in Jewish city anymore. Other people look at it and they say the book of Revelation and Ezekiel talk about there being a temple in the last days. In these times that Jesus is talking about, well, there has been no temple in Jerusalem since 70 AD, and there's no sign of that happening anytime soon. So these must be talking about something else. And so the Zionist movement really led to a resurgence of premillennialism, futurist reading, And particularly, it's what gave birth to dispensationalism, which was a belief that really focused on Israel, a distinction between Israel and the church, and led to some other beliefs as well.
Interesting. I think the Israel aspect is the one that I've heard the most growing up in Calvary. And I know that when Israel was reestablished as that modern nation in 1948, I know that was, for dispensationalism, probably such a big booming thing where it started to make everything click and come together, because it was like they were in exile, just like you see them all throughout Scripture going into exile from the Babylonians and so many others. And now they're coming back together. And so for a lot of people, those alarm bells tend to go off. This isn't something I'd planned to talk about, but I'd love to pick your brain about it, because this is an area I'm still trying to figure out right now in this season of my life. I've been trying to figure out what the right way to view Israel is, because what I tend to see from the dispensational side of things is there's this weird mixture of politics that gets wrapped up into it. Where I'll see people I know on Facebook who are dispensationalists, and, you know, Israel will bomb somebody and they'll be like, yes, this is good, this is awesome, this is righteous. And then if Israel gets attacked, they'll be like, this is horrible. And in my mind, I'm thinking, I know missionaries who are in those countries, like Christian missionaries who are in both countries, and I'm worried about them. Like, I don't understand why we're celebrating war and violence in these nations. And it seems to me that dispensationalists at times give Israel a free pass, where politically the Israeli government can do anything and they can do no wrong. Because I don't know if this actually comes from dispensationalist theology or if it's just the fruit of some warped views of it, but it almost feels like dispensationalists tend to view the modern secular nation state of Israel as God's chosen people, where everything that they do is sanctioned by God and directed by God. And to me, I struggle with that, you know?
I was in Israel in December of just this past year. And one of the cool things that we did, our tour guide was an Arab Israeli. He was born in Nazareth, which is an all Arab city in Israel today. And what he did is that he arranged for us to go into Bethlehem, which is, prior to a couple years ago, Bethlehem was the most Christian city in Israel, but it's also an Arabic speaking city. And it's really interesting, you know, just going into Bethlehem, and we had lunch at the homes of Arab Christians who live in Bethlehem, which is in Palestine, right? It's in the, you know, nation state, if you will, or whatever that entity is called right now, of the Palestinian territory. And so it was a really interesting and eye-opening experience for many people in our church to really think this through and think it through hard. You know, what is our role as Christians? And, you know, here are people who are Christians, and, you know, what is our view on this, and how are we supposed to support these people who are part of the family of God through faith in Jesus, and yet they are in this midst of this conflict with Israel? And all that to say, it added some important nuance. And I think you're right, we need to distinguish between the political entity and the politics of a country and the people of a country. So yeah, that's an important distinction.
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion, and it's one I still don't know the answer to. I feel like my views on violence and war, they are derived from my interpretation of the ethics of Jesus. And so for Christians, like, I don't necessarily feel like our role, like, I just saw, man, it really bummed me out. This was years ago, but I saw a Calvary pastor post on Facebook this gleeful celebration about how Syria had been bombed. And because in his view, it lined up with something that he thought was a prophecy. And just people on Facebook are, you know, all these dispensational boomer Christians are in there like, oh, Hosanna, Maranatha, praise the Lord, Syria has been bombed. This means this, this, and that. And I just can say for my generation, for millennial Christians, not post-mill, not a-mill, not pre-mill, but just millennials, it can be such a turnoff because we see humans. Like, you know, there are Syrian Christian missionaries on the ground. Like, I'm not happy that Damascus got bombed. Like, I'm worried about people. So that thing can be frustrating. I guess my view, I don't want to get canceled, but you know, my view that I'm trying to think through when it comes to Israel is as somebody who's still in that premillennial stream, I believe that God has a future for Israel. I believe that right now the nation, right? Like, sure, we've got Messianic Jews all around the world who have turned to Christ. But the nation itself is secular. The nation hasn't turned to Christ.
Political entity,
The political entity. And then also, you know, I think statistically most Jews aren't even followers of Yahweh anymore. I think most Jews are atheists these days, like just statistically. So I believe that, you know, if our view of revelation is true, then one day there's going to be this remnant resurgence where before all the end stuff comes together, God is going to bring a revival to Israel. So, you know what I mean? Like I see it's not that the church has completely replaced Israel and they're out of the picture and God doesn't care anymore. I think it's kind of one of those things where it's like, you know, that first love, he started this whole project of human salvation by picking this guy named Abraham. And I think it's a part of that concept of God's chesed, his loyal love, where he doesn't give up on his plans and promises. And so that's a beautiful picture to me where I see the end of the story, God brings Israel back into it. I also hold right now, at least to this view, where when I think of who is God's people, like who is God's people? I think historically that question has always been answered with those who follow Yahweh. When you start with Abraham, Abraham is God's people. His family is God's people. And then as, you know, you get to Moses and the nation grows, the Israelites who are following Yahweh through the desert, yes, they sin, yes, they make mistakes, but they're committed to following him. They are his people. Once you get to the point where you have Jesus, like he is continuing that plan that started with Abraham to save the world. And so the disciples and the Jews who convert to Christianity, like that is Yahweh's people. The Jews who reject Jesus, like they're not being faithful to be followers of Yahweh and to be his people. So I see the people of God have always been those who obey him and follow him. And I don't create these different classes. It's to me, it's just the same group, but it's morphed and it's changed over the years. So I think of God's people as the Messianic Jews who believe in Jesus today and the Gentiles who believe and follow Jesus today.
Yeah, well, you just described a very accurately a progressive dispensationalist viewpoint. So
there we go. I didn't even know it was. I heard one lecture from Daryl Bach years ago about progressive dispensationalism, and I was like, this sounds great. This sounds like the Calvary stuff I grew up in, or the Calvary stuff I grew up with, without all like the newspaper theology where it's like, you know, are the Russian helicopters the locusts in Revelation whatever, and is Elon Musk the mark of the beast? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That to me, that stuff is such a distraction.
Yeah. What?
Do you think I'm going to get canceled for any of that stuff?
No,
I don't think so.
I think what you said is actually what most Calvaries believe. Articulated because I don't think that the idea was novel to him. I think it was just articulated by him. He was an Irish Anglican clergyman named John Nelson Darby. He was an influential leader in the Plymouth Brethren movement in England during the 19th century. And so the movement received notoriety, this idea of dispensationalism, in 1909 with the publishing of what's called the Scofield Reference Bible, which is still, you know, in publication to this day. And there were at least three really big developments within the dispensational movement. And I think that pointing out these developments is really important because people sometimes paint a little too broadly when they come to dispensationalism. So the first stage was that Darby and Schofield one. And here's the thing about that, that view of dispensationalism was mostly focused on the dispensations themselves. Now, a dispensation, of course, just being a period of time. And what they were trying to do was just mark out the ways in which God has related to his people primarily at different periods and different times, and the biblical evidence for that, or corollary, if you will, would be in.
Yeah, can you slow down and just very simply break down what a dispensation is? Give us examples of some dispensations.
Yeah, so a dispensation is a period of time. It's that simple. It's a period of time in which God deals with people in different ways. And if you're like, well, I'm not sure I believe in that, well, I would say, well, have you read Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1 and 2, which are really important in this, right? Because they say that at different times and in different ways, God has spoken to people, but in these last days, he has spoken through his Son. And so these people broke them down into seven dispensations. And actually, I think if you would look at these dispensations, most people wouldn't disagree with them. Even people who do not call themselves dispensationalists, they would say, yeah, I mean, I can totally see where they're going with that. I can tell you what they are real quick. So they talked about the first dispensation or period of time being the period of innocence. Now, this is the area from Genesis 1 up until Genesis 3, well, about halfway through the chapter, at least, or the beginning of the chapter. That's prior to the fall. So that was a period of innocence. Mm. Next was a period of conscience, right? Because God had not yet given his law. So the way that he related to people was mostly through conscience. And that was from the time of the fall up until the time of the great flood. After the flood, that leads into the next dispensation, which is called human government. So humanity is responsible at that point to enact the death penalty, for example. And that period is seen by these people, particularly Schofield and Darby, as ending with the Tower of Babel and really Abraham. I wouldn't say necessarily Tower. I mean, it goes up through Genesis 11, basically, is what that means. Then from Genesis 12, which is, of course, begins with Abraham, they would say that that leads us to the time of promise or the Abrahamic covenant. And then from the time of that goes up until the time of Moses and the giving of the law after the Exodus. So that they would call that the dispensation of the law. Now, understand, this doesn't mean that God was saving people according to their adherence to the law. Now, some people believe that, but I would call that heretical. So, but anyway, some people claim that dispensationalists believe that. And I would just say, I'm pretty sure I am one and I don't believe that. So let's talk, right? And then they would say, we currently live in what is called the dispensation of grace or...
Wait. Okay, stop there because I don't want to lose that. So explain salvation then. Like, what do we actually believe about salvation? How does it play? Like, how does somebody pre-Jesus come to salvation?
Yeah, and this leads to an important development in dispensationalism, which I'll get back to in a minute, but I'll answer your question now. And that is that I would say, and Calvary Chapel movement for sure would say, that there's only ever been one way that God saves people, and that is by his grace through faith in Jesus. Those who came prior to Jesus' birth looked forward to the promise of the Messiah, which was given to Adam and Eve. Let's remember, right? Like it goes all the way back that God's going to send a man born uniquely of a woman, not of a man, the seed of a woman, who will crush the head of Satan. And so that promise, the proto-evangelion, the first gospel, Genesis 3 verse 15, is the promise that the entire Bible is about, that concludes in the end of the book of Revelation, right? So, and we would say that is the only way that God has ever saved people. He gave his law for a purpose, which is explained in Galatians chapter 3. It was to be a teacher that leads us to faith in the Messiah, shows us that we're incapable. Etc. So that's really important.
Yeah, that I think that's great. That's beautiful. And to me, that ties into the connection between like Abrahamic righteousness, where, you know, it says Abraham believed, he had faith in Yahweh, and so it was counted to him as righteousness, as being right in right relationship with God. Abraham didn't have perfect theology about Jesus or, you know, soteriology or atonement. Like he couldn't even fathom that stuff yet, but he was still counted as somebody who was a part of that saving plan of salvation of Jesus, even though he didn't fully understand it yet.
Yes. And so getting back to the dispensations, we talked about the law, so that it goes up through the crucifixion and resurrection and ascension of Jesus, at which point, starting with Pentecost, we have a new age, which is the one that I think most people would recognize as being a true dispensation, even if they don't call themselves a dispensationalist, and that is the age of the church. Right, so the church came into being at a particular period of time. Clearly, God is working through the church up until the age of the kingdom. So we currently live in the church age, sometimes called the time of the Gentiles. That's a reference to something Jesus himself said in the Gospel of Luke. And then that leads us up to the time of the kingdom, which, you know, begins with that thousand-year reign of Christ on earth, ending with God's judgment and the final rebellion, after the final rebellion.
Hmm. So would amill and postmill people pretty much agree with all of those different dispensations up until a certain point?
Actually, I don't think that most of them would disagree with any of them. Maybe with the human government one, that might be where they start to be like, eh. But then in broad strokes.
Yeah, postmill has some very specific views on human government. I know that, but... So then why do people have issue with dispensationalism? Like what are the hangups? Because I've got some friends that are preterists. I've got some friends that are postmill. I've got some friends that are amill. They've all gone to that, you know, the whole thing with John Darby and the Schofield Bible.
Yeah.
Scopes trial is another thing. But yeah, so what are people's hangups with dispensationalism? If it's not the dispensations themselves, then what's causing the
there
tension?
There are a few. Now, one of the, in my opinion, a little bit of a cheap shot, but here's what it is that they say, well, this movement, you know, dispensationalism, it only came about in the 1800s. So like, it's like a new kid on the block, if you will. They'd say, okay, maybe historical premillennialism has some precedent in history, but dispensationalism doesn't. I would say, again, I don't think that makes something true or not true. The second thing I would say is that shows that this person, if they're a preterist and a postmillennialist, that they do not understand their history either, because preterism and postmillennialism actually came about in the very final years of the 1700s, the 18th century. In other words, that's also a new kid on the block historically.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I remember the first time I ever heard of preterism, a friend of mine, we were both youth pastors together, and he left Calvary because of this, and he was trying to convince me about preterism, and he was like, well, Aaron, you know, if it's new, it's not true, you know, and that was kind of the phrase he used, and it rhymed, so, you know, it had that going for
it. It's a great saying, and I generally agree with it, and of course, a true believer in dispensationalism is going to tell you it's not new. This is what it's in the Bible. Okay. But, and I will get to preterism, because I think that maybe people who aren't familiar with preterism write it off too quickly. And I'll give you some things on that. But I just want to talk about the development of dispensationalism again. So just going back. So you have the first stage. That's the Darby Schofield stage. And their focus was actually not on eschatology. Their focus was on just saying, hey, look at this. These are the dispensations that explain Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. That was really their main focus. But there was, in that Bible, the Schofield Reference Bible, there was a commentary, kind of like how we nowadays have a lot of study Bibles. There was some commentary, and there was one particularly questionable comment that has gotten dispensationalism a bad reputation, and deservedly so, but I'll explain that in a second. The second stage of dispensationalism is what is now called classic dispensationalism. So the first stage is called kind of Scofield-Darby dispensationalism. Stage two is called classic dispensationalism. Now, this is a view that was held by a lot of Calvary chapels and maybe even some still today. And that has a few characteristics, but this was really done in the 1960s. And it was basically based on a book by Charles Ryrie, which you often hear his name thrown around a lot too. Charles Ryrie, and he wrote a book yes. called Dispensationalism Today. And here's his big focus, was that in the Scofield Reference Bible, in John, I can't remember exactly where it was. It was in the Gospel of John in one place, I think chapter 1, but I can't remember exactly which verse. There was a comment in the Scofield Reference Bible notes, which essentially insinuated that in the Old Testament, during the time of the law, the dispensation of the law, that people were saved by keeping the law. And Charles Ryrie said, No, Christians don't believe that. That's anathema. We actually believe that everybody's always been saved through faith in God's saving project through the Messiah. So,
and not that everybody's been saved, not universal salvation, but the people who have been saved.
Yeah,
just for clarity.
Yes. Those who have been saved, no one's been saved according to their own works. They've only ever, anyone who's ever been saved has only been saved through the saving work of Jesus, even if they were born prior to him. And then, of course, we would point to like Hebrews chapter 11.
And that would manifest into faith and belief and following of Yahweh, which the fruit of that is keeping the commandments and, you know, animal sacrifices for sin and keeping the law. But the law wasn't what saved. It was the faith in Yahweh that saved.
Yeah, it was an admittance of the fact that you were incapable of saving yourself through your actions. Mm. And it was a casting yourself upon the mercy of God and trusting in this thing that he had explained through the patriarchs, that he would one day send a man born of a woman who would be the descendant of Abraham, through whom all people of all nations would be blessed, through who would be the descendant of David, who would rule on a throne forever, the son of Solomon, right, who would be the true and greater king. And we could go on, right? But they had this prophetic witness. I mean, it's not like they didn't know about this, right? This was clearly laid out in the scriptures. So all that to say, the third stage, which is where we're currently at in dispensationalism, arose in the 1980s, and it's called progressive dispensationalism. Now, I will say this, that progressive dispensationalism, one of the key features is the idea of what's called inaugurated eschatology. Now, amillennialists...
That's my favorite eschatology.
Amillennialists also believe in inaugurated eschatology. So, but progressive dispensationalists do too. And here's what that means for anybody who's like, I don't get what these words mean. It's really simple. It means that Jesus...
That's going to be the title of this episode. I don't get what these words mean. With Nick Cady.
It means that Jesus inaugurated the kingdom, that he currently reigns over his kingdom. And he does that in heaven. And yet... He does it in two places, in heaven and in the hearts and minds of those who are his, who recognize his kingship and submit to it.
Yeah, and that idea that when Jesus was resurrected, he becomes the firstborn son and king of the new creation. Yeah. So it's like for us as Christians, it's that term that we use a lot of, you know, we're an outpost of heaven on earth. We're living for the kingdom now. It's already, but not yet. So as we're waiting for the final kingdom to come, in whatever way, you know, whoever's right, you know, post-mill, ah-mill, pre-mill, while we're waiting for that final kingdom to come, we can currently live in the power of that kingdom, in the presence of the king. To me, like, inaugurated eschatology, I'm in love with it because it doesn't matter which view you take. I think all of the views can benefit from it. I think all of us can focus on, no matter when Jesus is coming back specifically, he's given us a mission now. And it's not just to go to church and be a good person. It's to live for his kingdom and act like if Jesus is king, that really does change everything. So yeah, I'm all about, I still need to read the writers, you know, the George Eldon Ladd and all those guys. I've picked up quotes here and there, but yeah, I'd say as somebody who struggles with eschatology, discovering this inaugurated eschatology thing has been one of the most helpful things for
yes.
me.
Yes. And so I would say like that's a characteristic of progressive dispensationalism, is that it views God's work. So like what I described as being, you know, God has been doing something since the fall began that is working towards its ultimate culmination. And it has gone through these different promises that have come to Abraham. These are further revelations of the same thing. That's the progressive part, right? It's progressing. And so these dispensations aren't disconnected from one another. They're progressing. God's one plan is progressing through these different times, and inaugurated eschatology, which means that Jesus currently rules and reigns in heaven over his kingdom. This earth, as Jesus himself said, and as Paul the Apostle said in Ephesians chapter 2, this earth currently is under the rule of Satan, except for those who have submitted themselves to the kingship of Jesus. That's what it means to be a Christian. Jesus is your Lord. And so that's where Jesus' kingdom is now. But one day, and this is the already but not yet, what is the yet that we're waiting for? One day, his kingdom will come to earth in fullness. And so that is what we look forward to in inaugurated eschatology. Now, the opposite of inaugurated eschatology would be what is held by many classical dispensationalists. So these are the people who hold to that second stage in the dispensationalist process, which is characterized by Ryrie from the 1960s, is that they actually believe that rather than inaugurated eschatology, what we are living in is basically God pushed the pause button on his plan of salvation throughout history. He pushed the pause button on it when Jesus resurrected and ascended and said, okay, hang on. We'll get back to that in a minute. But first, we're going to have this age in which people are going to be able to come in and be saved, including Gentiles. So it's two different ways of looking at it. In the end, you kind of do end up in the same place, but it does affect the way that you think and feel about what's happening to you right now. If you believe that Jesus is currently reigning, that he's not just like standing by, he's not just in the on deck circle waiting for the next step to happen so he can get back in the action, but Jesus is currently reigning, that changes the way that you think about your life and what's happening in the world.
That's great. I love that. Nick, you had mentioned that you were going to get in depth into some of the preterism stuff. Could you do that really quick as we're winding this episode down?
I'll do it really fast. Here's the deal. With preterism, I mentioned to you that preterism only came about in the end of the 18th century, so 1790s, and it came about through the work of actually a Unitarian minister in England. All that to say, like, that is historically, it is a newer model of thinking about it. Now here's where they get into it, and this is why I say some people write it off too quickly. The goal of preterism was to interpret Matthew 24 verse 34 literally. That's really the linchpin of it. Matthew 24 verse 34 says, all these things, Jesus says, these things which I'm telling you about in the Olivet Discourse will happen before this generation passes away. So some people look at that and they say,
Can you summarize what happened in that passage?
Oh, yeah, he talks about the destruction of Jerusalem. Jesus is on the Mount of Olives prior to his going to the cross. And he's standing there with his disciples, and they're in awe of the temple. And Jesus says, I tell you the truth, not a single stone is going to be left standing upon one of these in short time. Then he goes on to describe some things that are going to happen in the future. And then he describes even the apocalypse, really, the things that had been talked about in the prophetic books, like in Daniel. And then he talks about some things which seem to be correlating with things written in Revelation. And then he says at the end of it, these things are all going to happen before this generation passes away.
Right, so a dispensationalist would view some of that as prophetic towards the end times, while a preterist would say, no, that all just happened with the fall of Rome.
Fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And so, because that's what we would call their hermeneutical key, or basically it's their starting point, and it's the thing that drives their interpretation. In other words, they say, well, if what Jesus said there is true, then that is the interpretive key by which we must interpret the rest of the futurist, the eschatological texts. So then they essentially reverse engineer everything else to say, how can we make Revelation and all that discourse and the Old Testament prophecies, how can we explain them in a way that honors what Jesus said there and says everything did happen prior to 70 AD. Mm. Furthermore, this is really important. They view Revelation as describing God's judgment upon Jerusalem for rejecting Jesus as Messiah, whereas futurists tend to see it as God's judgment upon the world system, if you will. Furthermore, they don't believe that Israel has any part in God's plan, so they hold to a replacement theology. And then finally, they hold to an early authorship of Revelation. They believe that Revelation was written in the late 60s AD, whereas amillennialists and premillennialists believe, and it has been the historic consensus of the church, that Revelation was actually written around 90 AD, which means it was written after the fall of Jerusalem. Which means if it's talking about future events, if it is a prophecy, as it claims to be in verse 3 of chapter 1 of Revelation, then the preterist says, well, because of that, it must have been written prior to the fall of Jerusalem. Whereas others would say, no, Jerusalem had already fallen, therefore these are speaking of other events, which are still to come. Mm. So all that to say, preterism has its history, its reason it came about, and it has those characteristics. Now, if we're going to land the plane on this, here's what I would say. Like, why does any of this matter? Cool, we learned some info on what different people think. But here's what I would say. There are three common approaches to dealing with eschatological texts, and I would describe them as, number one, fixation. Some people are fixated on these things. Number two, indifference. And number three is hesitation. So let's put it this way. Some people are fixated on these things, and they make them points of division amongst Christians.
Yeah.
That's unhealthy. Yeah. It's also, I would say, if you are fixated on these texts in a way that causes you, think about what it does to you, your belief in these things. Does it cause you to become arrogant? Does it cause you to become condescending towards other Christians? Let's go this far. Does it cause you to take a antagonistic stance towards your neighbors who, let's say, are not Christians? Because some of the views do that. And it's not just one of the views that does all of these things. Some of the views produce this in people. Does it cause you to be full of fear? I would say any of those things, if you're fixated on these texts in a way that leads you to antagonism towards people who disagree with you, pride, or if it leads you to fear, then you really need to reconsider maybe your position, but you definitely need to consider how you're holding your position. Because none of those things are healthy, nor are they the purpose and goal of God telling us these things. Rather, they should fill us with a sense, I would say, a sense of urgency, a sense of confidence, for sure, and they should fill us with a sense of concern, like it gets back to that urgency of my neighbors. If this is what the world is coming to, then yes, I can have confidence, but I also understand that there's an urgency to the preaching of the gospel that needs to happen.
Yeah.
Next, I mentioned indifference. Some people just look at this and they say, you know what? This has just caused people arguing and fighting. It tends to be divisive. It seems maybe confusing or unclear. Therefore, I just don't care. I'm just going to deal with
That's been historically that I've been guilty of that. You know, just I've been so overwhelmed by this and I'm like, Jesus is coming back. That's the main thing.
Yeah. And so some people say, I don't want anything to do with it. Well, let's remember that Revelation comes with a promise. Blessed are those who read and hear the words of this prophecy. So we should not be indifferent to it. It's meant for our good. Remember what it says in Deuteronomy 6, all the words of this law are given to you for your good. So if God's spoken a lot, which he has, about 30% of the Bible is eschatological in nature, meaning future eschatological, prophetic, it means that we shouldn't be indifferent about it. God has something important to teach us through it. And the third one would be hesitation, which I think isn't necessarily bad. I think hesitation can be good, right? It's the idea that people tread lightly when they come to it. I think that's probably a good attitude. I think that you can be too cavalier or too confident in your position. We should hold all of these things, understanding that they are interpretations of perhaps the most difficult things to understand in the Bible.
Right. Yeah, that's so good, Nick. I think, again, you know, going back to that analogy of, isn't it so silly for the family to be fighting and killing and imagine disowning your brother for disagreeing on a very complicated note that your dad left you about what time he'd be home. You know, a very, very complex with lots of riddles and analogies and illustrations. And it's like, wait, is there literally going to be a dragon or is dad just what is dad doing? I don't know. Yeah. It's like when we divide over these things, it's so silly. And I want to do better at that. Like I want to have a humility where I look at my post-mill brothers and my a-mill brothers and, you know, my preterist brothers and be like, hey, we're Christians. We're the body of Christ. Let's love each other. And yeah, there's going to be some very different implications of how we live out our Christian faith. We can't deny that. And I think that should be a follow-up episode. I think we should get into the implications of the views. But at the end of the day, like if we all focus on the Great Commission, we will be achieving what Jesus has told us to do while we wait for the finality of all things, you know? So I do find hope in that, but you're encouraging me to become a better student of eschatology because I do agree it is important. And I think that what probably dishonors the Lord is the indifference because it's like anything, like when it comes to, you know, soteriology, Calvinism, Arminianism, something in between, it's like we have to believe something. You know what I mean? If we just don't have views, then we're being intellectually lazy. But at least if we can study and land in one of the camps, we're being respectable in the sense that we're applying ourselves to study it. And I can respect somebody with a different view because I'm like they've done their time, they've put in their work, just like I have. And so there's a mutual honor I think in that to be like, hey, we care about this stuff that we apply ourselves and learn it, even if we end up in different places. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being here, Nick. And are you down to come back on another episode to follow up on some of this?
Yes, I have a lot of thoughts that I'd love to discuss with you about, like, how do these things play out? Is there such a thing as a dangerous eschatology? And yeah, let's talk about it.
That's the title of the next episode, Dangerous Eschatology with Nick Cady. Thanks for being here. Nick, are there any books you'd recommend people to read before we get off here?
It's a really good book. It's called Four Views on Revelation. I think that is a great book to read because it gives summaries of the different positions. What they do in that book is that they give somebody who holds each of those positions a chance to give the best explanation they can and also respond to other people and their views.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Theology for the People. New episodes are released every Wednesday, so make sure to subscribe to the podcast on whatever app you use. In our next episode, I'll be speaking with David Murray on the topic of mental health and mental illness and how it relates to the Bible and Christianity. Is mental health a physical issue or a spiritual issue, or is it both? Does the Bible talk about mental health? We explore these questions and more in that discussion. Theology for the People is a listener-supported program. If you have enjoyed or been encouraged by this content, please consider sharing it with others and leaving a review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you'd like to support this podcast financially, there's a link in the show notes where you can make a donation to support the show. Until next time, thanks for listening, and God bless you.